Bienvenue à la balado-diffusion sur Radio Créon du colloque sur le rapport Taylor-Bouchard qui s'est tenu à Montréal en mai 2009. Welcome to the audio podcast on Radio Créon of the conference on the Bouchard-Taylor report that took place in Montreal in May 2009.
Vous allez voir ça, vous allez nous aimer.
Both the presentations, can I just very briefly Abigail, I mean, I think your point is very well taken about the essential role of the voie juridique, absolutely. But the reason why we pitched it that way is because, and the Multani affair is a perfect metaphor for the whole process. They did have an agreement par la voie citoyenne between the school and the parents. And it was upset by the school board going against its own school to the courts, and then it went up, right? So here's a case where, and I think Dominique is absolutely right, there are all sorts of people who were not in the process, were terribly nervous about where the process was going, and were ready at all times to intervene and upset it, right? So in that context, you can perhaps understand, without entirely justifying, our emphasis on the voie citoyenne. Can I just say to Will, you got the situation right. I mean, we reflected in the report a lot of what people said, and then we reflected in the report at one point, we said there's not, a couple of points, there isn't that much difference. But why didn't we go further in this? I think you pretty well got the reasons why we didn't take on this more frontally. But I want to add something here. I think that if, even miraculously, if one day mythologies about multiculturalism being essentially ghettoizing, mythologies about the plots in the minds of Pierre Trudeau, back, et cetera, even if they all disappeared, we would have a different word. And the reason is, I think this is a very important point for the international discussion of this issue, there's the rhetorical framing. Rhetorical framing of Canadian multiculturalism is we will, as it were, explode and depart from the historic majority identity. It's no longer, it's sort of, it will be kind of volatilized into all these others. That is not a rhetorical framing which is possible in a society that still has three quarters of its population in the majority identity. You have to, it wouldn't be in Germany, it wouldn't be in Denmark for the same reasons. You have to approach the issue of how you open out differently, and you need another word. Probably, right? And I think that however much there's a mythology about differences on the ground between these two, there is a different rhetorical framing which I think is inescapable. Because these policies operate at that level as well as at the level of, you know, the actual policies on the ground. And I think for the purpose of the international discussion, it's interesting that Canada has these two rhetorical frames to, as it were, offer the world as possible examples.
I mean, I agree with what you're saying. I understand the reason why, and I tried to make this clear. I think that it's really important, and it was very an interesting aspect of the report to think about it in terms of what is going on here, that the civic forum, the citizen route, is being viewed as so important. And I thought there were lots of good reasons for that. And the context that you give of the Multani case was specifically something that I agree with. But a couple of things that I would say just in the part of the... Well, first of all, if we try to look at that message in the report outside of Quebec. And by the way, the Multani case got a ton of play in BC. It was viewed as extraordinarily important by the Sikh community, even though the issue of wearing a kirpan has not been an issue at all. But the Multani case, the sort of recognition of the democratic equality of Sikhs and of their article of faith as being part of what they get to wear when they participate in the civic sphere, which is, I think, how that was taken by the community, at least in British Columbia. That was enormously important. It led to the Sikh community asking the BC legislature, and I think the Manitoba legislature, to officially recognize the, I think it's five or four articles of faith of the Sikh community as officially part of the faith. So there was a big publicity around that, and the Sikhs were very proud and happy about that case. So when I read the Bouchard-Taylor report and there was that sentence, as for the handling of the adjustment requests, here we can clearly see the advantages of the citizen route over the legal route. And what had just been described was a back and forth and back and forth between a civic route and then to the courts, and the courts saying, yes, the kirpan's okay, no, it's not okay, yes, it is okay, I mean, finally. And then the description which followed, which suggested, if I'm not mistaken, that despite the fact that the Supreme Court had said the kirpan was all right, was not a safety hazard and should be recognized as part of freedom of religion, that three Sikh boys had since been told through negotiation that they could not wear their kirpans in school in Quebec. And that was because the majority and the minorities, the majority of the minorities and the majority of the majority, both considered this Supreme Court decision problematic. I just, to tell you the truth, my intuition is not that we can clearly see the advantages of the citizen route over the legal route. It wasn't at all. It was that there was something wrong here and that the civic dialogue would not have had a better result in this specific case. But I agree with you that in general, that in fact the legal route was there in order to make a certain group of people feel like citizens and to expand and challenge what religious freedom means in Canada, to broaden it. So that's one reading of, it could be the wrong reading, but that's the reading I have of that. And that the dichotomy in the report, which is specified on page 64, was just, it failed to make room for, I thought, that very important role of the legal process.
I agree absolutely that one of the important sociological/demographic differences concerns the nature of the majority group. So in Quebec, there is still a clear numerical predominance of the descendants of French settlers, whereas in the rest of Canada, people who are descended from settlers from the British Isles are absolutely in a minority. I mean, we're here representing English Canadian perspectives. Neither of us is descended from the British Isles. That would be just statistically that. There's no Anglo-Celtic. There's no group. I mean, the people who are descended from the British settlers are not only are they a minority. They're not even a self-identified. There's no sense of we amongst them. That's different. However, it was that group which itself decided that they wanted to form a new national identity that was no longer just an offshoot of Britain. I mean, this was the great transformation in the rest of Canada, and you can see similar processes in Australia or New Zealand, that the communities that used to view themselves as more British than the British, or as a kind of outpost of British culture, British society, decided that that's no longer who they wanted to be or who they were, and so they have constructed a sense of Canadianness, which I think is which is no longer defined in terms of descent from British settlers, but which is certainly hegemonic in the rest of Canada, and to which and the question, and therefore the question arises, when newcomers arrive, how do they relate to this very powerful, entrenched set of identities and practices and institutions in the rest of Canada that's emerged basically since the 1960s. And I think that, I'm just agreeing with you, but that the policies and programs that have been adopted under the heading of multiculturalism to deal with that question of how newcomers deal with the existing society with its entrenched and powerful identities and practices are very similar to the policies and programs adopted under the name of interculturalism in Quebec. And I agree that there's a difference in rhetorical framing, but the issue of how potentially marginalized, I mean, how culturally distinct groups deal with, how they integrate into, or how they're potentially excluded from the pre-existing society is quite similar in the two contexts and is processed in the same way intellectually. In terms of what are the underlying, both in terms of what are the underlying principles, essentially liberal democratic principles, and in terms of policy tools, and that it's important to acknowledge that, even if I agree with you that we would still be probably using different terms.
Your observations about how much more central Aboriginal issues would be in a BC context. Partly because I think that it was one of the crucial moves that the commissioners, not the commission hearings, but the commissioners made at the outset of the report to distinguish away Aboriginal questions and language questions for ways that kind of interestingly mirror Will's traditional national minorities, ethnic minorities distinction. I mean, Will's version is we can afford to safely recognize self-government on the part of national and linguistic and indigenous minorities without risk of a slippery slope to ethnic minorities. The commission's stance is kind of the opposite. Because as a fixed point of Quebec public debate, we know that there must be very sharp limits on indigenous self-government, lest the northern third of Quebec think that it can leave if Quebec leaves, and because of the foundational character of language politics. There has to be a move to say, we can safely accommodate Muslim and Jewish and immigrant religious communities without risk of being led to conclusions that we know prima facie we reject about Aboriginal peoples and language groups. It was a way of immunizing the politics around religion, I think, to distinguish away the kind of constitutional foundations that come up whenever self-government problems come up. And I wonder whether that distinction wouldn't also make sense in BC in a different way. I mean, a whole lot that's fundamental is still up for grabs in BC with respect to Indigenous questions and First Nations questions. The public politics of symbolic reconciliation and painting over murals, that's good and interesting and important, but there are land questions and self-government questions that aren't yet settled in a way that a commission could come along and try to reconcile the non-Aboriginal population to the pre-existing settlement. There's basic constitutional policy questions that are still unsettled that have to be decided in a different way, aren't there?
You can tell I'm just nodding and agreeing with you and agreeing with you. And I'm glad, Jacob, that you asked that question, because I nearly didn't put in the presentation anything about Indigenous peoples because I didn't want to be interpreted as suggesting that Indigenous issues are issues of reasonable accommodation. However, although I think that the distinction between the analytic distinction between national minorities and ethnic minorities is a useful one, I don't think that it is reflected either in the way that the public views the issues, and this is a big problem, and it was a big problem in the religious arbitration debates as well, and that's something that is an it's interesting to think through what the ramifications of that are. But actually, more disturbing to me is the way in which it's sometimes not reflected in public policy, and specifically in Supreme Court decisions. So, for example, a recent Supreme Court decision, the CAP decision, is a decision about a policy in British Columbia about fisheries, which allowed Indigenous people to have a special fishing time, 24 hours, so the commercial fishers can't fish and Indigenous people can. And the commercial fishers took the BC government to court, saying that it was racially discriminatory. And the Supreme Court of Canada constructs Indigenous people as a racial minority, not as a constitutional group in that decision, which is a very recent decision. And it could have constructed Indigenous people as a constitutional group, but it did not. And it said that it was not, it was a racial minority, but it was a policy that ameliorated the disadvantages of a racial minority. Well, in British Columbia, you can bet, very unsurprisingly, the Japanese fishers are right in there saying, well, we have a historical injustice based on race as well. And now this decision has caused a lot of problems because of the interesting history between Japanese dispossession and the dispossession of the Japanese fishing fleet and who got the boats, namely the Indigenous fishers. So there's this massive. And so in the public policy it's reflected, there's a disconnect between the analytic categories we sometimes use and the policies that are being made to manage diverse people. I think that what would happen in BC if there was my hypothetical report is that that issue would be broached. And that there would be an attempt to say, look at Indigenous peoples, our first peoples, this is a constitutional question about fundamental issue that is quite distinct from the other issues. However, some of the ways in which public policy and Supreme Court decisions fail to make that distinction would probably be one of the topics of conversation.
I would like to accept your invitation to make my comment in French, because it's not my mother tongue either, but je suis plus à l'aise en français. Donc vous vouliez un regard extérieur sur cela, et je dois dire que je passe le plus clair de mon temps quand je ne suis pas à Montréal à expliquer par exemple à des étudiants allemands ce qu'est la laïcité à la française ou encore ce que veulent les Québécois. J'entre donc tout de suite dans la matière en faisant un petit commentaire, en vous expliquant aussi que mon regard que je porte est celui d'une historienne. Donc, par exemple, quand je regarde sur des concepts multiculturalistes ou interculturalistes, il est vrai que, comme ça, on ne peut que constater que c'est les mêmes valeurs qui sont sous-jacentes, mais si on les replace dans un contexte politico-historique, il est bien clair, c'est au moins... Vous allez me dire que c'est simplificateur, mais c'est moins simplificateur que de regarder juste les concepts théoriques et les... Donc, j'explique à mes étudiants, rien qu'à voir la chronologie, il est clair que le multiculturalisme, c'est peut-être un cadeau que ce conflit entre le nationalisme québécois à la suite de la Révolution tranquille en concurrence avec le fédéral a fait au monde. Est-ce qu'il y aurait eu une politique multiculturaliste formulée par Ottawa s'il n'y avait pas eu ce conflit? Je pense que c'est lié. Tout comme la charte, la loi sur les langues officielles est clairement un produit d'un conflit sociétal concret, historiquement identifiable. La charte de 82, pareil, et les oppositions qu'il y a eu au Québec sont liées évidemment avec le processus de rapatriement de cette charte et non pas les contenus de cette charte qui recueille d'ailleurs, d'après le récent sondage, une très grande adhésion des Québécois. les valeurs elles-mêmes. Mais il faut replacer, je crois, ces choses-là dans leur contexte historique. J'explique aussi toujours à mes étudiants que les lois ne sont pas éternelles. Et là, je reviens à ce que vient de dire Abigail. Les lois telles qu'elles existent, le cadre légal est toujours le résultat, même assez lent, d'évolution sociétale. Il n'y a qu'à comparer le cadre du 19e siècle au nôtre aujourd'hui. On voit que finalement, ce sont des processus qui existent dans la société qui, un jour ou l'autre, se traduisent dans le cadre légal. Donc, c'est à ce titre-là que je ne vois pas une très grande différence entre les deux niveaux. Ils sont interliés de façon très, très concrète, pas à 2 mois de différence quand on regarde exactement ce qui se passe actuellement, mais à terme, tout ce qui se fait dans la société se traduira un jour dans les lois et dans le cadre linguistique. J'ai fait un peu la même chose qu'Abigail a faite. Elle a comparé une situation existante de conflit potentiel à un rapport non existant. Moi, j'ai voulu comparer le rapport Taylor-Bouchard à la situation en Allemagne et en France. Et là, on trouve aussi des conflits existants, mais aussi des rapports existants. Et donc j'ai fait ça non pas pour trouver des modèles éventuellement d'exportation d'un cas à l'autre, puisque en tant qu'historienne, je suis très très réticente à cette histoire d'exportation de modèles toutes faites. C'est très intéressant de porter des regards, mais on ne peut jamais vraiment exporter quoi que ce soit, puisque c'est chaque société qui doit négocier en elle-même avec son propre passé historique la façon concrète de faire. Ce que j'ai trouvé, c'est que dans les 3 cas, il existait des rapports, mais que le regard public et la discussion autour de ces rapports avaient la même réduction culturaliste. Je m'explique, les rapports étaient très, très explicites sur les discriminations concrètes, sur le marché de l'emploi, sur les chances dans le système d'éducation, tout plein de facteurs que tout le monde connaît ici, mais dont on ne discute plus. Et donc, cette réduction culturaliste me semble être présente dans les 3 cas et semble vraiment être nocive. Le rapport Stasi en France est très, très explicite sur les discriminations concrètes des jeunes musulmans en France. Mais la seule chose qu'on a discutée ensuite, c'était les foulards en classe. Moi, je crois que c'est un peu la même chose qui se passe ici, et c'est très dommage. Quand vous regarderez, et je finirai là-dessus, la liste des recommandations concrètes, puisque les 3 cas contiennent des recommandations très concrètes, eh bien, c'est la même chose au Québec aussi. Regardez juste les recommandations concrètes du rapport Taylor-Bouchard. En tant qu'Européenne, je ne peux que souligner que c'est vraiment très bienvenu que ce soit aussi concret, que ce soit si bien, mais on attend la réalisation. Et ça, c'est donc le débat politique qui devrait suivre maintenant et qui n'est pas tellement généralisant. Merci.
I mean, I agree. I agree. I should say. Sorry. There's just no way in British Columbia and raised in Alberta that I'm going to have French language skills. Okay. Prêt? When I read the part of the report that was very interesting to me was the. And I've met Marie McAndrew, who was partly involved in, and I've spoken to her about this. Anyway, the part of the report that piqued my interest was, and I don't know very much about it, so I'd be interested to hear more about it, and that is the school teachers who are saying, give us a way of resolving these conflicts. And in fact, reiterated this, I take it that the reaction on the part of school teachers to the report was not altogether positive, because they felt that, and again, please tell me if I'm wrong about this, but that this was really put on them now to resolve these conflicts, and that their message was that they should not be going to court, that the conflicts should be resolved in the classroom. To some extent, that's how I read the most recent decision about the supposed assault with the hairpin. That is, the principal immediately phoned the police to say that, see, look at the kirpan is a weapon. It wasn't a kirpan that was used. The judge said, look, this would have never resulted in a court case if it would have been anybody but a Sikh doing this, and so therefore the student would got convicted, but it was an absolute discharge, or there's no record of it. So my understanding is that what the school teachers were asking for was specific criteria, not general abstract values, but very specific criteria about how you end up. So integration, for example, is a value. It's a very abstract value. And so one wants to know, in concrete terms, how does that value manifest itself either in Ontario, in BC, or Quebec, and how do you go about making fair judgments that are not informed by institutional bias, so that you want to be sure that relevant considerations end up being taken into consideration, and not the sort of biases and prejudices of that majorities and minorities have in these situations. And that's why I said at the end of my presentation that the more concrete criteria would be ones that specifically address and that require that people address whether something important to the, in this case, the religious identity of a group is actually at stake, whether something really is threatened by a law. And I would say religious arbitration has to be decided in that, partly in that way too. Polygamy has to be decided partly in that way. And in addition to this idea of jeopardy and how we would, and the debate should be about how we decide that. How do we decide? And what kind of evidence do we look at? And in these ways, courts can sometimes be very helpful. We have to be worried about validation, whether people are being coerced to adopt practices, and whether the practices harm, and what criteria we're using to assess harm, and what safeguards can be put in place. I think that those are very pragmatic criteria. They're meant to be, and I propose them as very pragmatic ways of making decisions that could be used in the courts as well as in the classroom.
Alors maintenant que nous avons un chuchoteur attitré à côté de Abigail et de Will, j'espère qu'il va y avoir des questions en français. Just to cut out the middleman, though, I'll ask my question in English. My questions are mostly addressed to Will, although I'd be happy to hear from anybody on the panel, indeed anybody in the room, about these two points. So I basically agree with you and have publicly on record as agreeing with you about the interculturalism-multiculturalism distinction. But there are two observations that I'd like to make and invite you to comment on. The first is that to the extent that there are, so you pointed out two hallucinatory elements in the perception in Quebec about multiculturalism. One is that it's a plot against Quebec, and the second is that it's basically a ghettoizing sort of ideology. So it's interesting that at least part of that hallucination is collectively shared, at least in parts of English Canada, right? Not the part about the plot, right? But the idea that multiculturalism is ghettoizing rather than integrating is something that has gotten a lot of traction in English Canada too. Indeed, I would argue that the first real sort of intellectual manifestation of that position was Neil Basundas' book, Selling Illusions.
Right.
Yeah. Very quickly translated in Quebec, obviously, and got a lot of. But this was an English Canadian writer. And if you look at the latest pronouncements that have come out of Jason Kenney's office in Ottawa, it's clear that even the people who are officially responsible for the policy right now think that the policy has been too much about separating and distinguishing and arguably even ghettoizing, and the message that is coming out of Ottawa right now, whether this will just be a question of rhetorical pose or whether it will give rise to actual policy changes on issues like dual citizenship and what have you, is something that remains to be seen. But it's interesting that the illusion or the hallucination is shared across the whole country. So I wanted to, it's interesting to reflect on why that is, because I agree with you that when one actually looks at the substance of the policy and the way that it coexists with other bits of policy, it's clearly part of an integrating policy. So that's sort of a first observation. The second observation, this is again against the background of basic agreement with you about the interculturalism, multiculturalism distinction being a distinction without a difference. I'd be very curious, by the way, to hear from people in the audience. There's so many smart people who I respect who think that there is a real difference and who are willing to argue for it you know, till the cows come home. But I'd be very eager to hear a defense of the distinction. But the second observation I'd make is, I wonder to what extent multiculturalism has become, or interculturalism, have sort of become idle wheels in a lot of the in the way in which the practice of multiculturalism on the ground of Canada has evolved over the last 20 years. There's a Keith Banting, your colleague at Queen's, sent me a piece of research that was done by one of his students, where she canvassed the decisions made by the Supreme Court on issues to do with cultural accommodation. And the total number of references that she uncovered to Section 27 of the Constitution was, I mean, I think I'm right in saying that there was just one, right? There was none?
No.
I'll keep on going, and then tell me why I misunderstood. And this is a general theoretical point that goes beyond just the Canadian debate. You know, the Taylor-Bouchard report defines sort of philosophically a way of thinking about laïcité, about secularism, that attempts to achieve a sort of compromise between values that are equally important to the liberal democratic order, namely neutrality on the one hand and religious freedoms on the other, and comes up with this idea of laïcité ouverte. It's arguable, I think, that the same thing has been going on in Canada, where you have had a lot of the space that's been opened up for accommodation, for religious accommodation, being done on the basis of an interpretation of individual religious freedom rather than... So it could be that the report doesn't, you know, despite the fact that for strategic reasons, which I think you are perfectly right in pointing out, ended up sort of fudging on the multiculturalism, interculturalism issue. At a deeper level, it could be that the fact that it sort of, what is actually grounding the argument, both in Quebec in the Bouchard-Taylor report and in a lot of the decisions that have come out and created precedent in Canada, has very little to do with multiculturalism, Section 27 at all, and a lot to do with a way in which we've interpreted individual rights. Now, and I'll finish with this, it could be that the way that the judges have chosen to interpret individual rights is sort of driven at a subconscious or conscious but not always explicit level by their remembering that Section 27 is back there in the background. But it's interesting that, you know, both from the point of view of Canadian jurisprudence, but also sort of generally philosophically, you can actually get quite a lot out of the standard liberal package of individual rights.
So the on the first point about the myth of ghettoization, it's not. I mean, it's found across the country. That's right, obviously, but it coexists. I mean, so we have periodic. Ebbs and flows of that criticism. That criticism has been made in English Canada from the very beginning. From 1971, we've had episodes in which influential voices every 3 or 4 years make that objection. Nonetheless, and you certainly hear it you see it in op-ed pieces or on talk, you know, talk radio or whatever. Nonetheless, the polls show. I mentioned one that just a couple years ago showed 85% of Canadian of people in English Canada are proud of multiculturalism. 82% think that it's a defining characteristic of Canada. And those numbers have been more or less edging up. They're troughs and valleys, but multiculturalism has. And if you do those polls where you give people a list of 10 things and say which is defining of Canada, you get hockey and multiculturalism and everything else is. So it's deep. It's a very deep. It has deeply penetrated the institutions of Canada, schools, museums, media. It's part of training. I mean, this is one of the things that's mentioned in the report, the Bouchard-Taylor report, that it seems that there's more training and multicultural sensitivity in amongst journalists in the rest of Canada than in Quebec. But anyway, it has sedimented itself in institutions and in public consciousness such that what you get is I mean... it's an interestingly kind of ambivalent. I mean, there are lots of Canadians who are ambivalent, obviously, about accommodations and there are lots of racists and so. But all of that kind of coexists with what is currently a cross-party consensus and overwhelming public support for multiculturalism. I mean, you might think that's odd, that there's so much anxiety. I mean, there's lots of anxiety about immigrants and about accommodations, but multiculturalism has achieved this kind of consensual status amongst the political parties, amongst most of the intellectual elites, amongst the social science researchers, amongst bureaucrats, and public institutions, and so these episodes of critiques of ghettoization come and then disappear and leave more or less untouched the core commitment to multiculturalism. On the issue of the second question about Section 27. So I read the thing that Keith sent you. It's an interesting study, but how many times the Supreme Court referred to Section 27 in its judgment? So that's the multiculturalism section. And her argument is that there was one case where the reference to Section 27 was determinative, that had the court not been able to invoke Section 27, it in all likelihood would have come to some other decision. So in the absence of Section 27, a different decision would have made. There are several other cases where the Supreme Court invoked Section 27. There have been many cases where the Supreme Court refers to Section 27, but in all of those cases, she says it could have reached the same decision without Section 27, just for the reason you said, that most of these cases are about individual religious freedom rights, and that you could get that, and other countries have got to, like the United States, has gotten to many of the same results without a multiculturalism clause. Having said that, so I basically agree with your premise that lots of these decisions, lots of these issues could be resolved based on an interpretation of individual rights to religious freedom, of conscience, worship, whether or not we had multiculturalism or interculturalism. Having said that, it's the ability to interpret individual religious rights in that way is, let's say, facilitated by what I take to be a genuine kind of multicultural revolution in liberal thinking, which involves the recognition that some kinds of group-differentiated rights or accommodations are needed to achieve freedom and equality, so that the core liberal values cannot be always achieved by colorblind application of undifferentiated citizenship rights, that in order to pursue those liberal values, we have to be open to the possibility that various forms of group-differentiated treatment is needed. And that's a revolution that's taken place in relation to gender, in relation to sexual orientation, disability, as well as in relation to cultural and religious minorities. But it really is a shift from the way these issues were discussed 50 years ago. It's a series of potential of ways of thinking about liberal values have emerged into the intellectual universe in a way that I think multiculturalism helps to crystallize.
Just a quick comment?
Yes, I was being curious to know when you refer to those sondages that
have been made in the rest of Canada towards multiculturalism, what people understand by multiculturalism. Because this is a kind of word that covers lots and lots of things. And I wonder, because you talked about those, and Abigail talked about those anxieties that also exist in English Canada. So when people talk about multiculturalism, when they ask those questions in polls, what do people think they are referring to? Particular policies, particular decisions, a general idea of what they take Canada to have become? I'd be really curious, because I'm sure you would find very, very different things. And if you went deeper, I think you would probably recognize the same kind of resistance that you find in Quebec and elsewhere.
Yes, I wanted to say something similar to what Dominique said, talking about the kind of approval rates. So going back to Madame's intervention, in Germany, multiculturalism is highly respected and highly accepted, except that the specific German interpretation of multiculturalism is that it's multiculturalism with German guiding values, whatever that may mean. In one instance, for example, the province of Baden-Württemberg had a recent case of a Muslim teacher who wanted to teach in school wearing the hijab, and the local courts decided that she should not be allowed to do this because that was in distinction or in violation of the rules that organize whatever teachers should wear and should not wear. But it was in violation of the rule that Germany's multiculturalism is based on Christian values, right? So it seems to me, you know, reports about people's opinions, you said, well, Canadians love multiculturalism. Well, sure, we also love Canadian, you know, peacekeeping forces, right? Because it reflects, well, not everybody, but it reflects very well. And multiculturalism is one of those things that Canada has very successfully exported, largely to a lot of work that has been done by people in this room. But it seems to me that we should not get carried away by how enlightened people actually are, right? And it seems to me that that refers to what you were saying before. Quebecers don't know exactly what anti-culturalism is, but they know that they like it better than they like multiculturalism for the same reasons, because they interpret it differently and they can actually interpret the way that they see fit. Thank you.
I mean, I agree completely. These are heavily tied up with basically forms of national narcissism, and I think that's true on both the English-Canadian side and the Quebec side. So in English Canada, a lot of the support for multiculturalism is people want to feel good about their country. And so what can you feel good about in English Canada? I mean, it used to be peacekeeping, but now we don't do any peacekeeping. So it's particularly, and it's defined always in relation to the U.S. So we think that we look for what do we do better than the U.S. That's the basis on which we build national self-esteem and national pride. And so we think we do diversity better. And that makes it a core component. And there's some evidence. I mean, it's not that people. I mean, this is very important. It's not that people have a kind of inherent. People in English Canada have an inherent altruistic like of minorities or of diversity. It's nothing like that. What English Canadians have a strong sense of national pride, and that one of the things over time that has come to be a source of that pride, as I say, it's always based on some kind of relative comparison with people with relevant frames of reference, and so you know we think we do better health care than the Americans. We don't have guns, we don't have capital punishment, and we have multiculturalism. These are things that are the bases of. That can coexist with. I mean, you're absolutely right. That on that basis, you can have very high levels of public support for multiculturalism in polls, and it be actually quite disconnected from whether you feel very sympathetic to an actual immigrant living next door to you. There can be a disconnect between one's commitment to multiculturalism as a defining feature of Canadian identity and one's actual emotional responses to people next to you. But having said that. I agree we shouldn't rely exclusively on these polls, which may not mean that much. But if we do look at things that are meaningful, like these comfort scales, so you know there's a long tradition in sociology of asking questions about would you feel comfortable having a Muslim move next door, or having a Muslim as a son-in-law or daughter-in-law, or having a black person as a coworker. I mean, we have lots of sociological data on these things, which are important, and relate to issues of discrimination and prejudice and stereotypes and so on. And on those scales, English Canadians, on a comparative basis, do pretty well, and that they do have quite high, internationally speaking, very high levels of comfort with ethnic and racial and religious diversity. And I think that is tied up with the multiculturalism policy. It's not the only factor, but it's one factor, and I think there's a long story to explain why I think that there's some evidence that multiculturalism has enhanced that level of comfort.
So this is a follow-up, I guess, to Daniel's question, and something that I've been wondering about for the last few years, which is partly what do we mean by multiculturalism, but more specifically, what I think often collapses into multiculturalism, which is true to a large degree in this report, but maybe not exclusively, is we're often talking about religion. And so really my question is, When we're talking about multiculturalism, are we talking about religion, or is religion a subset? And most of the examples in this conversation have been religious examples. I mean, you did mention women and gays and lesbians, but in your work, actually, Will, you explicitly exclude them, you know, as not what you're talking about. So my question is, are we including them, you know, I mean, in this universe, or are we just talking about religion? And if so, then is this a story that just goes back to Locke, you know, and in the history of toleration and figuring out what that means? And as we confront new religions, we just have to rethink what this means.
So at the moment, obviously, in both Quebec and the rest of Canada, the debates are around religion. That was not always that way. That if we look at the history of multiculturalism in Canada, there's basically three waves. The first wave, multiculturalism was first demanded, many of you will know, by white European ethnic groups, overwhelmingly the Ukrainians, also the Italians and Dutch and Germans and so on, Poles. And they did not make any religious claims. So if you look at what the Ukrainians were asking for, there was no religious accommodation issue to what was driving the original mobilization for multiculturalism. The second big wave was, through the 70s and the 80s, was racially defined groups, particularly because we'd been getting large numbers of Jamaicans and Haitians. And so multiculturalism shifted from, it was originally defined on ethnic grounds, basically country of origin grounds, shifted to dealing with issues of racialized groups. And this was reflected in which kinds of groups got government funding, whether they were defined on ethnic basis or on pan-ethnic racial grounds. And then since the 1990s, we've seen a third wave of multiculturalism, which is, and again, those that second wave, there was nothing about religion. Jamaicans, Haitians were not making religious claims. The third wave, which basically started in the early 1990s, then religion did become prominent, and it was particularly because of the rise of Muslim immigrants. The Somalis were one of the groups that was most vocal in raising issues of initially raising issues of religious accommodation. So at the moment, for a good chunk of time since the early 1990s, religion has been dominant. But I think that one of the reasons why Canada's had some success in these issues is that religion is not separated out from these other issues, or not viewed in abstraction from these other issues. It's now embedded in a larger policy framework of multiculturalism, which shapes how we think about issues of religious accommodation, both conceptually but also politically, in terms of what are the processes, what are the consultation processes, representation process, deliberation processes, that the multiculturalism framework, which emerged in these earlier waves for white ethnic groups and then racialized immigrant groups, that has created a set of institutions and practices and habits and virtues, if you like, which have helped us grapple with this third wave of religious claims. And I think it's important to keep those connections together.
I have a question for Will now about the two kinds of oppositional definition. You say that there's something deeply misleading in Quebec's oppositional conviction that interculturalism has to be very different from a segregationist, non-integrationist multiculturalism. But Anglophone Canada, too, has an oppositional character to the way it construes some things. And part of how it construed multiculturalism as defining of Canada was in opposition to the ostensible American melting pot. Given the sociological reality of what the American melting pot always was, which is to say that there were Chinatowns and Little Italies and minority language newspapers and ethnic pride parades and that kind of thing all along, presumably that means that multiculturalism is supposed to be even less assimilationist than that, which suggests that there could be some grounds in Quebec for thinking that what Anglophone Canadians mean by multiculturalism is, well, it has to be at least less assimilationist than what they see when they look
south. Je vais faire une traduction assez vite. J'ai demandé s'il y a une très grande différence entre le multiculturalisme canadien et le melting pot américain. Si ça ne veut dire pas qu'il y a peut-être aussi une vraie différence entre le multiculturalisme et l'interculturalisme, parce que le multiculturalisme canadien doit être moins intégrationniste, moins assimilationniste que le melting pot américain.
Yeah, so I completely agree that the English Canadian perception, which is very deep, that the multiculturalism approach in English Canada is fundamentally civilizationally different from the American approach is a myth. And it's a myth that has been repeatedly demolished by social scientists, but it clings, and it clings for the same reason that the myth about interculturalism persists in Quebec. These are deep national mythologies. I hope no one took me to be saying that Quebecers are somehow more prone to these national mythologies than English Canadians. I think these are endemic features of political life in all countries. So the American, I mean, if you look at how schools in New York City deal with issues of diversity, it's very similar to the way that schools in Toronto deal with it. If you look at policies of cultural training for journalists or for healthcare workers, so the guidelines in hospitals are going to be very similar in Chicago as in Winnipeg or Vancouver. So So what is the difference? The difference between the U.S. and English Canada is primarily that in English Canada we have a federal law on the Multiculturalism Act of 1988 and a constitutional clause, Section 27 of the Constitution, which is to say we have a kind of symbolic federal level commitment to multiculturalism, which has no analog in the U.S. So that at the level of public institutions, of frontline managers, in terms of pedagogy, multicultural education, a lot of that we got from the U.S. I mean, a lot of multicultural education in Canada is just imported from the U.S. So, in English Canada, we do have this very strong symbolic, statutory, and constitutional commitment to multiculturalism, and I think we should recognize that for what it is. It's not a civilizational dispute, a difference. It doesn't mean that there's all that much difference on the ground in terms of how issues are actually dealt with, but it is one relevant difference, because it has, I think, provided it has helped to put some of these issues in English Canada beyond narrow partisan. Politics that by giving it a statutory and constitutional basis, multiculturalism has achieved a kind of it has made it possible, I think, to create forms of discourse and institutions at the federal level, at a larger macro public level, not just at the front lines public institutions level, but at the larger public debate, which has helped to, in some ways, reduce the likelihood of English Canada having these kind of moral panics around immigration.
Yeah, sure. Okay, Tariq Modoud from Britain, so non-Canadian, non-Quebecer. I'd like to comment on the how one can test what multiculturalism might actually mean to Canadians in practice, and, as it were, how well or badly they might be doing, especially in relation to international comparisons. So Will rightly distinguished, partly as a response to what other people have been raising, about questions, distinguish between questions in opinion polls or surveys that say, you know, are you for multiculturalism, and questions that are much more specific, hypothetical questions about, you know, what if you're... daughter wanted to marry an ex, and so on. And I agree, that's an important distinction. But there's a third set of sociological data as well, which is illuminating, and which connects with issues about economic integration and discrimination in workplaces, labor markets, and so on. there's quite a lot of work, but there's one very good systematic study that I'd just like to point to. This is a study done by, or led by, Anthony Heath and Li Yu-Chung, based in Oxford, but it's an international study involving, I think, about 13 countries, about half a dozen or so from continental Europe, northwestern Europe, but Canada, the United States, Australia, South Africa, Israel, so about a dozen or 13 countries. And what they looked at were two measures: the likelihood of different categories of people defined by ethnic origins, being employed or unemployed. That's one measure. And the other measure was being in professional and managerial occupations or not. And they took people who were migrants, and here migrant means, actually by ethnic minority here, they mean people of non-European descent. So a kind of shorthand way of saying that is people who are not white, Asian, African, and possibly it could be Latin and South Americans as well in some of those countries. And they looked at people who were non-natives, migrants of this categories, and people who were second generation. That's to say, they were natives, but nevertheless, they weren't white. And they controlled for a number of things. They did various regressions and so on, controlling for, obviously, things like qualification levels, age, how long been in the country, and so on. All the kinds of things that they could control, that data allowed them to control. And the quality of the data wasn't perfect from all of those countries, but they did a pretty good job. And the results were that virtually all of those 13 countries, they created something that they called an ethnic penalty, which was what you pay for being an ethnic minority in relation to white natives. And for the first generation, that's to say the migrants themselves, there was an ethnic penalty in all of those 13 countries for both those measures, in work or not in work, and in managerial jobs, not in managerial jobs. But actually, Canada was the closest to parity. And then for the second generation, which in a way is a lot more interesting, because also people have qualifications which are more comparable to the qualifications of their peers, because there isn't an issue about the value of overseas qualifications and so on. For the second generation, they found that in most of those 13 countries, the ethnic penalty for both those measures persisted. But there were a couple of countries that the second generation were doing as well as the white natives, or sometimes better. And interestingly enough, Canada's the country that came out best. But, and this is also interesting, the United States was the country that came out second best, not very far short from Canada. So whether it's multiculturalism as such that's doing the work, or, you know, something else, or whatever we mean by multiculturalism, but nevertheless, you know, this thing about, well, is Canada doing something different compared to these other Western countries? And the book that studies is called Ethnic Minorities in Western Labour Markets. Canada did come out as best. But, you know, talking about national narcissism and so on, well, the UK didn't do too badly either. Not as well as Canada or the US, but somewhere around third, fourth. And, of course, we did a lot better than continental Europe. And there are comparative other. So we don't care how we're doing compared to the United States, but we do care how we're doing compared to France and Germany, who tell us that our multiculturalism is a policy error, that we're paying for some kind of failed integration. And we say, yeah, well, actually, you know, you're building up problems. So I think that, too, is a very important measure. Of course, it's not a direct measure of policies. It's a measure of lots of things. And ethnic penalty isn't exactly the same as discrimination, because there are a couple of other factors that they can't measure for and control and so on. But the authors are of the view, rightly I think, that most of what would be identified in the logistic regressions as ethnic penalty would be discrimination. But there are a couple of other factors that they can't control for. And, you know, you can't say they're directly related to policies. They're related to to a variety of things. But it does seem to me that, you know, Canada's got some things going for it in this kind of international beauty contest.
Catherine Walker from Queen's University. I was taken by Abigail's comment about historical redress and reparations for the past. And I'm wondering, to what extent does the reparative aspect of multiculturalism play into these discussions? So if multiculturalism is to some extent reparative, once we do our reparations and cover up all the egregious murals, do we need a new word, or does something? Do we need to shift into a different paradigm? So if we take care of the reparative problems that multiculturalism aims to sort out, and if we appreciate multiculturalism as mandated to do that, is there some shift that needs to happen once we've apologized, once we're no longer perpetuating nation-building, monolithic nation-building policies? So is there some shift, and if so, can interculturalism accommodate that type of shift?
I didn't mean to suggest that historical injustice is the only problem that has to be addressed in BC. That's what I actually wanted to point out, was that the way in... Okay, so, I mean, this is actually going back to a couple of questions that Will has been answering, but I think they're interesting questions, and Daniel's is one of them, about what we're talking about here. To a certain extent, as I see it, what this report is about is not about a crisis in Quebec society, so much as a crisis in democratic institutions. That one of the things that multiculturalism created in Canada was a rise and a heightened sensitivity to the claims that were being made before public institutions, claims by ethnic minorities. And the publicity that those claims received was greatly increased, if not the number. The report claims that the number in Quebec was not increased, but I think I wonder if that's true. But claims that ethnic minorities have made about wanting aspects of their identities recognized and protected, accommodated, has been very much what multiculturalism is. In BC, I think that right now, the way in which that heightened claims making would take place is through a narrative about historical injustice. But once the murals are covered, I don't think the claims would go away, because there's lots of problems in every society. It's just, where is it that those claims would fit in? One of the things that arises from the report is, in this society, I guess the claims are fitting in a different way. There might be a narrative of historical injustice out there, but that's not the main narrative by which the claims are being advanced. But whether it's in BC or in Quebec, what's common to those two contexts is that the heightened sensitivity about these claims leads all of us, minority and majority, to take a look at our institutions, including our elite institutions like the legislatures and the courts, and to be dissatisfied with the way in which they're resolving the claims. And so that's what the interesting common feature is, how that's worked out in the different contexts. I mean, this report offers a sort of a map of how to figure it out. But that's I think, what's going on more generically.
Just one quick comment about the role of historic injustice in relation to multiculturalism. This is another example of the evolution of the policy. There was no link, conceptually or politically or legally, between historic injustice and multiculturalism for the first 20 or 30 years of its existence. And it's actually only under the conservatives, interestingly, that they created a new subunit within the multiculturalism program on acknowledgement, commemoration, and something. It's the units that's now responsible for administering these apology and compensation and redress agreements with the Chinese and the Japanese, the head tax, and so on. It's an interesting question about how we understand this decision to link redress issues under the umbrella of multiculturalism. One version, I mean, there have been lots of people in English who said that this is needed in order to emphasize that issues about cultural diversity are not, it's not like we all enter the public sphere in as a tabula rasa with our differences that we now have to negotiate. We enter the public sphere in historically determined circumstances of inequality as a result of these historic injustices, and therefore it's essential for multiculturalism to build into the multiculturalism policy recognition of these legacies of hierarchy, exclusion, discrimination, and therefore redress agreement, apologies, and commemoration of injustice should be absolutely central to our understanding of multiculturalism. It helps us understand the context within which issues of diversity arise. And so lots of people on the left, if you like, have been pushing to incorporate redress into multiculturalism. On the other hand, it seems pretty clear that the conservatives' just motivation for doing this is not because they want to highlight issues of of power and inequality and so on. They're just doing it to get votes. They are hoping to make inroads into the ethnic vote, and that these are what some people call boutique multiculturalism. That you try to pick off individual ethnic groups through kind of these targeted compensation or redress agreements, even at the same time that you're kind of walking away from more general commitments to anti-racism, anti-discrimination, or multiculturalism. So that is actually, in my view, an unresolved issue at the moment. That we've over the past several years built redress into multiculturalism, but in a way that I think is still unsettled.
Je vais faire mon commentaire en français. Je vais faire mon commentaire en français. Jean-François Quentin, un citoyen. Donc. Peut-être reprendre un peu plus large, je pense, le contexte. Je voyais la commission Bouchard-Teller comme une façon d'adresser des difficultés d'intégration pour les immigrants et pour les autres communautés. Et puis là, j'écoute ici ce matin, et puis je vois beaucoup de... On regarde les vagues d'immigrants qui sont arrivés dans le passé, qu'est-ce qu'on a fait pour eux autres. Ma question concerne plutôt le futur. Puis les futures vagues d'immigrants, est-ce qu'ils vont avoir les mêmes caractéristiques que ceux qu'on a connus? Est-ce pour faciliter l'intégration des futurs immigrants ou les futurs réfugiés qu'on va avoir ici au Canada et au Québec, qu'est-ce qu'on peut faire pour eux autres? Un petit peu, comment ça s'aligne ces choses-là dans le cadre des recommandations de la commission?
Well, I think I've said what I think that the great challenge. I mean, I think that the challenge here is to get our democratic institutions up to speed in dealing appropriately, and that I mean both the dare I say the citizen route and the legal route. I mean, I don't like that dichotomy, but to get those institutions to have, sometimes they make good decisions, but they're not transparent decisions. And the criteria that they're using to make those decisions aren't transparent. And I think that that causes a lot of uncertainty. So that's one of the great challenges in order for people to feel like they exist in a context where they're democratic equals. But I think that, you know, we're never, that part of the great promise of multiculturalism, and here I talk in a very abstract way, and I'll leave it to Will to get us back down to actual nuts and bolts of public policy, but is that it emboldens, appropriately, it emboldens people in Canada who are minorities to make claims that the way in which individual rights have been interpreted in the past are exclusive of their basic values. I think that the opportunity, the open door to do that, whether they get vindicated or not, the open door to do that is just never ending. That is a good thing. And that there always should be this opportunity for people to make claims against the status quo way in which individual rights have been interpreted, and for our institutions to be able to reflect back on how they have made decisions in the past in ways that exclude particularly important practices or groups from enjoying freedoms that, after all, have been designed from the perspective of John Locke and forward, and have not been designed for various minorities that do exist and live in Canada.
Just one quick comment about the future. There's one thing that's not mentioned in the report, and that very few people are discussing, but which I think is worth just flagging as a coda, that both in Quebec and Canada, we have all our policies are operating on the premise that we're recruiting permanent residents. That's the absolute core of our approach, both in Quebec and the rest of Canada, is that people come as permanent residents and whom we encourage to become citizens. The Canadian government over the last few years has been shifting in a remarkable way and undiscussed towards the greater use of temporary migrants. We're talking huge numbers. People think of temporary migrants as being the Mexicans who come to pick tomatoes. That's just now a fraction of the temporary worker programs that Canada has. This has not been publicly debated. I view it as fundamentally antithetical to the approach that we have both in Canada and in Quebec, hugely dangerous. But the government's kind of getting away with it. The employers are happy with it, and the Conservatives, for their own reasons, have decided to embark on that quite dramatic shift in policy. And I mean, so that would be one thing to just attend to, is that I think we're in danger of shifting the very foundations of our policy if we start shifting away from permanent residents towards more temporary workers.
It seems what's important, what influences on the situation of immigrants and the minorities in Canada at all is the international context. For example, what happened after September 2001, it had big influence. All these situations and the context of this commission and the other ones happened, and they were more important after this event. And what's going on actually in the Middle East between Muslim people and the other ones, after all of these events, the situation of multiculturalism and the other ones are much more important. Because always it has been the question of multiculturalism in Canada, but only in this period of times, and whenever what happens in happens something in those countries, it's more important is multiculturalism and the reaction of the people here. For example, in a small town in Quebec, they don't let the people, the women with hijab, come to that city. So I think it's one important element touches both parts of Canada, English Canada and French Canada at the same time. But probably maybe some small cities of Canada are more touched in this regard.
Yeah, I mean, I agree completely. So 9/11 created ramped up anxieties and made life miserable for lots of minorities. And obviously, if that happens, if some version of that happens again, and it needn't be on Canadian soil, or if things go dramatically worse in the Middle East, I mean, things can very. I think things can quickly become very nasty here in Canada. We can't isolate ourselves from those international events, and we will get. Yeah, so I disagree with that.
Thank you. My name is Daniel Blakey. I'm at Concordia University, but originally from Winnipeg, Manitoba. So, a fellow Westerner, such as that is. And my question was just to go back briefly to the distinction between the civil process and the legal process, and something that Professor Eisenberg said about the... something that Professor Eisenberg said about the teachers. And so I don't want the question to be taken as my saying that the legal process doesn't have an important role to play, or that... exact criteria handed down from the legal process to this particular context might not be useful or helpful. But I wonder sometimes just in that very sentiment that, well, as a teacher, what I would like out of this process is just for someone else to tell me what exactly I should do at work, And then I can do that, and then I can go home, and I don't have to rethink all these issues for myself. I don't have to be challenged in my general view, but I can accept what criteria are handed down to me as imperatives that I need to follow at work. And I do that in my work life, but I'm not engaged at a more broad level, lends itself to the danger of another mythology, which is that expert policymakers alone, by handing down clear criteria that don't need to be interpreted by the people on the ground and in the right ways, can fix our problems or fix conflict without what I think the message of emphasizing a civic process is to say that people actually have to go home with these issues and think about them for themselves and without always going to an outsider to give them clear criteria of what just to do, that they have to take up that task for themselves in an important way. So I just wanted to close by returning to that distinction and how they interact.
Right. So true, very true. On the one hand, teachers want to, or people in a lot of different public institutions, social workers as well, want to have criteria by which they can decide issues so that they don't have to use their gut instincts. And on the other hand, external criteria can't be so specific as to force people to take decisions out of context and just sort of apply a process. You know, let's see if we can get 9 people in the room, we'll ask them, we'll vote. Like, I mean, something like that. However, so what that means, though, is that criteria are needed that don't constrain people in that sort of specific way, that ask questions of people, and that ensure that they have answered those questions. And I guess that's what I am arguing for, is criteria not that will constrain teachers or judges or legislatures in all respects, but will get them to reflect with some humility on their own biases, that will require of them that they assess evidence that is comparable about the importance of particular practices, let's say, to religious identity, that will take very seriously the evidence about how things are validated and the costs of safeguards, and that those things, that answering those questions, which is different in different contexts and along different dimensions, will provide a better guide than merely the abstract values, because the real problem in the cases that I've looked at, and these are cases about indigenous spiritualism, about sukkahs on balconies, about polygamy, about taking hallucinogenic peyote, about about veiling, about religious arbitration, is that leaving people without questions to answer, whether that's in a civic forum or in a court, renders decision-making opaque and leads people to rely on sometimes what are gut instincts informed by stereotype and prejudice rather than transparent or translucent evidence.
Professor Zinberg, Professor Kivninka, Professor Lede, very big thanks.